This is Trading for Keeps. I'm Brian.
And Michael. Today we have a special guest, Jeff Coventry. He is an expert on modern monetary theory. This might be a new topic for a lot of people out there. So if you've heard the topic before at all, or if you're not quite sure, anyways, what I want to do at the beginning here is forget what you know or what you think about the national debt and about the Federal Reserve just for a minute. And then certainly bring up some good questions about this later, but I just want you to hear him out for a minute because I think it's a fascinating topic that a lot of people have not heard of. So Jeff, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Great to be here. And so I want to clarify one thing. I won't call myself an expert, but we'll jump right in.
Fair enough. Well, we do like to get to know the person behind the topic a little bit. Can you give us what brought you to financial theory?
Yeah, it's a great question because it was not at all on my radar. And so the story basically for me went revolved around the great financial crisis, as we'll call it. And I'd been a long time entrepreneur, business guy, done a few startups, and so just kind of had your head down every day doing business stuff and trying to keep the business growing and make money, et cetera, et cetera.
When you mentioned the financial crisis, you talk about the 2008 Great Recession.
The economists, I kind of know they call it the great financial crisis. So yeah, the great recession, however you want to refer to that, 08 and following, and the spillover into Europe, et cetera. So we've gone through ups and downs before, but this one was just something else, right? And watching the havoc play out in human lives, it made me sit down and say, okay, I'm not hearing anything in mainstream media circles or any other sources I'm looking at that actually explain what the hell just happened and why this is going on. And, can this be different, or is this just an inevitable part of the world, a force of nature, if you will. And so I just started trying to dig in to understand, what on earth is going on. And I did have, I won't call myself a recovering libertarian, but I did probably lean more in that direction, prior, during that period. So, I was exploring all the Austrian theories and, is gold the answer to our monetary woes and, et cetera, et cetera. Long story short is that I was fortunate enough to be introduced to some of the main economists behind what's kind of known by shorthand as MMT, Modern Monetary Theory, including Stephanie Calden, who wrote the book behind me on the shelf, and others, Randall Ray and some of the others, because I live in Kansas City, and they were at that time were all at the UMKC economics department, which is still going strong, but now some of those have moved on. This all hit me cold. Like I did not get it at first. I was like, no, there's no way, like this is just bad. but I kind of stuck with it enough to really kind of answer my questions, like work through like, why is this really real? All the what ifs, right? What about, you hear all, the hyperinflation concerns and, et cetera, et cetera. So, and I basically read everything I could on the topic, and began to dialogue with folks in that area, and the light bulb, kind of went on. A lot of people are smarter than me. The light bulb goes on a little quicker, but it took me probably a year of just like trying to wrap my head around this stuff. But anyway, that was kind of how it happened. And it's, been a fun journey since, of just connecting with this growing community of people that are trying to help educate folks and get word out that, listen, things aren't quite how we've been taught.
So what kind of business were you in when the financial crisis hit?
So I've been involved in renewable energy for a long time. So that was the company that we had started, which at the time was called Tradewind Energy. We were actually in a kind of a critical early stage of that business, which later became very successful, and we've since sold it. But it was a delicate time, and the crisis hit at a pretty bad moment for us. We lost a big contract, and you know, it was like kind of a rough period. But it was renewable energy at the time, mostly focused on wind. We later added solar energy storage and things like that. So.
Okay. And then did you say that you were an entrepreneur in that? That was your business?
Yeah. So I was one of the principals and founders of that company, being involved in an e-commerce startup before that. That was about 5 years and fun ride until 2000, when everything kind of collapsed. But we had one of the first companies doing electronic commerce for businesses. So kind of running their online commercial side. So we were doing that in the late 90s, and then that business got closed by the VCs when the crash happened. We were pre-IPO and they decided to kind of liquidate. So that's my fortuitous turn into renewable energy came as a result of that fund.
Okay, that's interesting. That's very interesting. It's always fascinating to me how people's journey progress and the perspective that they bring to each situation, especially the fact that you came from more of a libertarian standpoint, which, you know, I think I have some libertarian leanings, but at the same time, I know I have some others too. I try to be as independent as possible because there's, I feel like a lot of sides have some validity to their arguments. And so,
yeah.
But all right.
It's so good perspective.
Exactly. So MMT, this is, like I said, a fascinating concept to me. I just stumbled across it maybe a month ago. That's when I reached out to you and said, can you come and tell us about this?
Sure.
The traditional method of thinking is, how are you going to pay for it? You know, we have this nation, the United States of America, great nation, best nation ever. I've served it myself. I love it. We're sitting here on $28 trillion worth of debt, and we're going to have to run up a whole bunch more debt just to build our bridges and to pave our roads and to build our airports and to fund our schools. And everyone keeps saying, how are we going to pay for it? That's the big question, is how are we going to pay for it? So we essentially, what I think the mainstream idea is we sell treasury bonds, right? And then China buys them. And then now we're in debt to China. So China owns all of our debt. So we're in debt to China because they bought all of our treasury bonds. And we're just hoping they don't call up the debt anytime.
Right.
So that's kind of the idea out there. What is MMT's concepts around this?
Yeah. So you did kind of hit on some of the main, I'd say, everyday person understanding of kind of the government's world of money, right? It's probably not how a lot of the more advanced mainstream economists would have, a little bit more sophisticated view than that. But the average person, probably myself included back in the day, would have had those kind of basic assumptions. And a lot of it's because of the language we use. And the language you use is a vestige of kind of days gone by when there may have been some reason to use that language, such as debt, to describe something like a U.S. Treasury. That's not really applicable anymore. So just kind of back up to an MMT and a summary, and it's probably difficult to get a sound bite that encapsulates the body of scholarship that's gone into developing these ideas. But you can start with the idea, a fairly simple one, that a nation that issues a currency, and I used a specific word right there, issues a currency, has a different environment that it operates in, a different kind of way of thinking than myself, an individual, a business, a state or local government, none of which issue a currency, right? We all use U.S. dollars as our kind of unit of account, and we exchange U.S. dollars for the most part, and some may do Bitcoin and other things, but ultimately probably trading in and out of U.S. dollars to buy and sell things, right?
So exactly. Even my Bitcoin, I know, is worth just shy of $60,000 right now.
Right, right. The frame of reference. So, so the issuer of the currency is different than users of the currency. That's kind of a fundamental thing to think about. And so when we start breaking down what's actually going on behind the scenes, when we see things like the government making payments and then the government issuing bonds and then the Federal Reserve stepping in and its role of kind of clearing accounts and working between banks, et cetera, and operating in this bond market. Like all these things are, they're a bit of a, like a smoke and mirrors over some underlying very basic ideas, which is the government, when it spends, is creating a US dollar in a bank account. It's issuing a currency that it alone issues. And so that shows up in a bank account. And then because of a bunch of reasons that are somewhat historical, we go issue treasuries in the amount of the dollars that are showing up in bank accounts that are in excess of the ones that get taken back out for taxes. And we can kind of get into that a little bit, but this whole thing we talk about as the national debt is just a vestige of payments being made into the economy, less payments coming out of the economy. And all this money sitting there is our base, basically our base money supply. And our governments, you know, decided through votes and various procedures to go turn those into treasuries and pay interest on them. It's not necessary, but it is what we have. And
so you're
unfortunately,
saying
we call it debt. And everyone gets confused.
U.S. bonds to pay for our roads. You're saying that when we decide to go and pave I-95 with federal dollars, the federal government just creates that money, gives it to the contractors or the DOT to spend, and it's newly created. And the fact that they create a bond on the backside is essentially pointless.
Yeah. So I kind of take it in pieces that all payments the government makes are done by, you know, a vote in Congress is what actually creates the ability to create money, right? Congress passes a bill and says, go spend, you know, $1 trillion on pandemic relief. No one has to go find that money. The money was found because Congress said, go spend this money. And when it says, go spend this money, that authorizes the Treasury to go create payments. And that authorizes the Fed to go clear those payments with the banks that the bank, the Fed's basically the bank of the government, right? Among other things. So it's going to stand there and make those payments. And that results in a whole bunch of money entering into the economy. Taxation is pulling money out all the time, and taxation volume goes up and down for a whole host of reasons, a lot of which the government really doesn't control on a day-to-day basis, having to do with how robust the economy's doing and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that leftover, there's always a, you know, some difference between what's going out and what's coming in, that lands into bank accounts. And to kind of get into this issue of bonds, we have this requirement of the Fed managing to an interest rate. And that's kind of how we've told the Fed to go manage the macroeconomy by adjusting interest rates. That's kind of an interesting conversation to have in itself. Like, is that really the way to manage an economy well? But because the Fed says, I need to hit my target interest rate, and all this money starts flooding into the economy, creating excess reserves, excess, you know, settlement accounts at the Fed. The Fed now, that interest rate is going to start dropping because banks aren't in demand for, you know, bidding up the price of overnight reserves. And so they have to suck those reserves out somehow. Well, what happens when you issue a bond is you're exchanging reserves for a treasury security. And voila, you get your interest rate back where you want it because you've balanced out the number of reserves in the system. Now, that's a bit technical, a bit complicated for a lot of people, but it is the reality of these things we call debt are really just a kind of an interest rate management tool. And it's something that's left over from, you know, back in the day when we had gold standard and things like that, there was a whole different kind of criteria.
Well, no. And I think it comes back to a little bit, you know, traders, I know that people in the stock market, we can understand the supply and demand. At the end of the day, it sounds like when the price of money was high, there was not as much demand for it. So they lower the price of money by lowering the interest rate. If the interest rate's 4%, there's going to be less people that want to go and borrow money. Interest rate drops to 1%, a lot more people want to borrow money. And so as long as we're cutting the rate, demand goes up. Supply goes down, demand goes up, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of that's the way that economists think about why we have the Fed in this role of managing the macro economy by moving an interest rate target up and down. Is they think that transmittal through a whole series of steps turns into an increase or decrease in overall demand in the economy. Basically, it's trying to influence the credit channel, right? The banking, lending, credit creation side of the economy, which is a big chunk of the economy, and move it upwards or downwards in terms of volume to try to, you know, increase spending or decrease spending or, you know, demand in the economy. And I think a lot of folks in the MMT circles are a bit skeptical of the ability of that channel to really function the way it's described. And, you know, somewhat argue that by raising an interest rate, you're increasing an income channel at the same time. You know, you're paying more to people that hold money. So you're raising incomes. At the same time, you're trying to dampen the economy. So there's kind of some counter forces going on, even as you're trying to achieve one goal. But yeah, I think a lot of folks are kind of skeptical of that really being, is that really the right way to manage, you know, the country's economy is just this one magic overnight interest rate. We'll just do all this incredible work to move things around. I think there's a better way than that, but. It is fair enough.
I think, you know, I think a lot of people are going to have just, you know, even a hard time wrapping their mind around the MMT in general. But so basically getting back to that.
Yep.
It sounds like we can just print as much money as we want. We can build as many roads as we want. We can pay everybody a universal income, universal health care, free college for everyone. Is that essentially what we can do if votes are essentially the money? And I mean, where's the cap? Where do we, you know, I know,
right.
You know, you got to have a restriction at some point. You know, I don't want to go pay $1 million for a Coke like they do in Zimbabwe, because you know, we also have the thought of inflation out there, and we haven't really gotten to inflation yet. That's, you know, the Federal Reserve, they have two mandates. They're supposed to keep inflation low or about 2%, which they're actually below. So they're trying to raise it right now.
Right.
And they're also trying to keep employment at their maximum. That's the Fed's mandate.
Yeah.
So what, how does MMT help deal with inflation? I mean, if we can just build anything we want, put as much money out there as we want, is there a concern about inflation?
Yeah. So I think fundamental to the MMT framework is that it's trying to shift the where we talk about constraints from something that's more of a fiction to something that's more of a reality. And so this question of, you know, are we constrained because our government can get too much in debt? Well, as we've talked about, it's a bad word to use, that treasury bonds are debt. So there's not a solvency problem with the US government. It's not going to run out of ability to create US dollars as long as we have a functioning government. So the question then is, like, if that's kind of the wrong constraint, what is the constraint, right? And you know, you could say, you know, can the government run out of laws? You know, are there too many laws? You know, that we've kind of run, we've used up the pool of laws, and you know, there's no more to have. We you know, got to wait until we can get some laws back off the books before we can create a new one. That's kind of the fiction of the way we think about money, right? It's not a physical thing that we're running out of. So now shift over to real resources. Real resources are what they are, or what they can become or be created to become within our capacity as a people, right? And as a land, and as you know, relationships with others. So there isn't an endless amount of you know, humans to do labor and raw materials to make concrete and steel, and at any given time, physicians and nurses and care providers to meet the needs of health, et cetera. So that's actually where we want the debate to be, is like, okay, where are the real resource concerns? Where are the constraints? Where are they going to show up if we start shifting resources into the public sphere from, say, private actors? Where are we going to run into problems? And it won't be the ability to make a payment. It's going to be the ability to, we want a national high-speed rail system to crisscross the country, and we want to do it in 2 years. Well, you're going to run into some constraints in a real hurry, right? Put a 20-year plan in place and think about how you're going to shift resources from, maybe we build less speculative condos in Miami Beach, and we, move some of that construction capacity into Midwest rail construction. And, suddenly we found an answer to kind of the resource problem, right? So I think MMT will say, it's the real resources, which may translate into inflation. And we would generally try to get away from this generic boogeyman of inflation being this word you throw out to kind of scare people, into break it down. Like, where is the issue? Where is it showing up? Why is it showing up? What's the constraint? Get into the details, get into the weeds, and figure out, is there an answer to that? Or is there not an answer to that? Or is the answer done over time? Make that the framework for policy debate, instead of this thing like, oh, we're running out of money, or, oh, inflation's bad.
So maybe, can I jump in? So we always hear these debates about the national debt, right? And there's like, we're making these interest payments on the national debt. We have to pay for Medicare. We have to pay for Social Security. We have to pay for defense budgets. The more we spend on servicing this debt, it's like a loan that we have to pay back. So I guess, what would your response, like, the system that we have, they just not pay that debt? We just ignore that as a thing, and we just say, put your resources to these other things? Or is that something that we practically have to care about? I guess I'm kind of curious, it's interesting to think about these things. What are the practical ways that government can address these things, and how does it kind of relate to our everyday life, I guess?
Yeah, that's a good question. This question of the interest. So interest in an MMT framework, interest is a policy variable. It's a choice of what the Fed is saying it wants the interest rate to be. So I want to step back one quick thing to set a comparison here. Back when we were on the fixed exchange rate system, that was a different financial picture than the one we're in today. So if your currency is tied to something you don't control, so it could be gold, which you don't have an unlimited capacity to create, right? It could be, Argentina pegging to the US dollar, or having debt, and maybe not pegging, but having debt in US dollars, which then they don't create that, right? So they got to go find that. There's all these ways to cause your currency to not be able to be as flexible as it can be to serve the public good. So a lot of countries are stuck in these kind of rigid frameworks that create problems for them. And so our history as a country, in fact, we used to issue bonds because we didn't want people claiming our gold, right? So because we tied our currency to gold, and then we said, oh, you can exchange your US dollars for gold if you want. And we said, well, hey, let's tie people up so they can't do that. Let's issue long-term securities. And now they stick their money in this interest earning bond. And now they can't, while that security is outstanding, they can't go claim that gold because now it's tied up in 30 years, et cetera. So it's a way to basically keep the hands off the restricted stuff, right? That's all gone. That's all in the past. And so this back then, that debt actually meant something. It had a criteria that does not exist today. It has an interest rate component and risk that doesn't exist today. So fast forward to today, we don't have any of those kind of ties. We don't have any of that restriction on our US dollar. And so we could just say interest rate zero permanently. And so be it. Like, no one can do anything about that. China can squawk all they want, but at the end of the day, they're selling us stuff and collecting US dollars. They can't do anything else, you know, with this question of the interest rate. So the point being, the interest rate is in our control, not in someone else's control. We're not subject to bond vigilantes or, you know, hedge funds, you know, challenging us, et cetera, et cetera. Other countries can be. That's a really important point. So you do hear of some of these crises that happen, and it's often because some of these countries have their hands tied in ways that we and many other countries don't. But it's not just the big guys.
Can I jump
in
there?
Just U.S.
Talk. Yeah. I want to just get that a little bit more because we do have interest on debt. I've got the U.S. debt clock pulled up here. Four largest budget items. The fourth largest is interest on debt. It's $400 yeah. billion. Dollars. We owe yeah. $400 billion every year as a country in yeah. interest.
So we're just creating that money and depositing it to wealthy people who have dollars, or countries that have dollars. Right. It's just like anything else. We create the dollars that go out the door to pay the interest. We can't run out of them. We'll never be in a position where we can't pay that interest. But the question is that a good idea? Like, do we want to keep giving interest, you know, payments to people that hold our currency? At this point, that's a policy decision we've said yes to. I think there's probably a debate to have as to whether that's, you know, a really good thing to do in the long term. But it's not an issue of ability to have the money.
So just, I guess it's a policy question. You're saying at the end of the day, like, we could just choose tomorrow, just, okay, we're not going to pay the debt. And, you know, tough luck, China, tough luck, all you rich people that hold U.S. debt. I mean, I guess I would presume there'd be some consequences.
We're basically there right now, right? I mean, what's our interest rate? It's so low, right?
Yeah, I guess there's existing debt that's already out there, right? On, like, you know, bond conditions we've already had in the past, right? That's eating us up. And then as we spend more, I guess we could modify the interest rate going forward, right? Yeah. To be zero. I guess that's a policy debate to be had. But I guess, you know, if the United States ever flicks the switch tomorrow and says, okay, guess what? We're just going to, I would say, print money, create more money. Mm-hmm. We all presume that would have some kind of ripple effects, you know, or, you know, we, again, Michael was saying, like, the Zimbabwe dollar, would people lose faith in America, or would people not, you know, transact, or, you know, there always seems to be some kind of catastrophic, like, we're going to be the Weimar Republic in Germany, you know, where, you know, everything is going crazy. I guess that's the vision I have in my head when governments just unilaterally start printing money or, you know, creating dollars out of thin air.
A lot of that's because we've kind of linked in our minds that end result of a crisis that led to those things with our government just making spending, which doesn't have the same crises that led to that, right? So we didn't lose a third of our productive capacity to a war and then lose, you know, the Rhone Valley to France and then, you know, have a reparation imposed in gold that we don't have on our shores in the, you know, case of Weimar Germany, to then have to then get our country back on its feet, start actually feeding our people and try to buy gold from abroad with exports on a depleted, you know, weakened productive capacity. You know, that's the situation you're in Weimar Germany. That's got nothing to do with just governments making payments in an increased capacity to do something that looks like it's in the interests of the people, like building infrastructure or, you know, paying for school or, you know, whatever. So there's always these kind of unique cases, and you can kind of tell why this is important, because how quickly those things ended when the criteria that led to them ended, right? So Weimar Germany didn't have an out of control inflation problem that it could not get out of, right? It got out of it when we stop these stupid reparation rules and other things, and you know, kind of, obviously they got out of it for some pretty nasty reasons as well. But
so I guess just maybe one follow-up. So as a practical matter, I guess you're saying we have a finite number of resources in America. You know, mm-hmm. we can't build a, you know, a rail system across. It takes time, money, people, places. So money is our way of kind of, like, allocating resources, right?
Yeah.
But I guess presumptively there'd be some consequence if we just start creating. Like, I don't know, I guess that is the fundamental question I have about maybe this modern monetary theory, right? The MMT, yeah. Is that, like, you know, I guess does that mean that the debt isn't a problem? That, you know, this is just an artificial, we should just go to bed tomorrow and just be like, okay, you know what? The world's going to be okay. You don't have to worry about this. This is not a long-term concern of our country. Those politicians and that website are just, it's just a bunch of baloney. Like, we could just don't lose any sleep over it. You know, we're going to be fine. We'll just, you know, we'll print more money. I mean, we'll be okay.
In terms of treasury bonds, you know, this national debt clock and all this kind of stuff, it's just silliness. Like, there, just think of it as a money supply. So a growing economy, a growing nation is going to have a growing money supply, period. It just is. Like, so, you know, get over it. It's been, you know, 100 years of growing money supply, and they freaked out at a million and 10 million and a billion and 100 billion and a trillion. And every time there's a new big number, everyone freaks out. But it's the same thing. It's just the money supply growing. So the question is, are we using that in a productive way and in a way that is going to be enhancing or not enhancing life? That's kind of what my interest is in all of this, is are we advancing collective human interests, and I'd throw an ecological and kind of the broader, you know, planetary interests in how we are deploying resources with our nation's currency, or are we doing it in harmful ways? You know, we can go create a lot of currency, make things and that we blow up in the sands of the Middle East. I'd argue that's not a great way to use the sovereign currency to advance overall human well-being. There are other ways we can, but it's not going to end up in necessarily a financial crisis. Now, sure, governments can do really dumb things, and they do really dumb things. I guess I have a certain amount of belief that this country has at its core a whole bunch of people that want to see good things happen, and we'll find ways in the balance to get as much good and hopefully more good than bad to come out of this. That is the political process, right? Right. Just to kind of hit on one thing you said, I just want to be very clear on this. We don't have to pay off the debt. It's not debt. It's just money that exists in the economy that's earning interest.
Yeah, I guess this is the trouble with a lot of people, is just like, you know, we always analogize to ourselves, you know, I spend more than I make, then, you know, I owe somebody some money. And so if the government spends more, I guess, than they make, so that's the point. We think of income as tax revenue, and we spend more than the tax revenue come in. Inevitably, we owe somebody that difference, and we have to pay it back. And so if it's the Chinese and we don't pay it back, I'm assuming they're going to be pissed at us. We don't pay it back. Or if it's our allies or something. But I guess that's the, you know, when people think about it, it's like, how can we just, I guess it's the fundamental thing. How can we spend more than we get in as income, right? And I guess that's the trouble. And then, you know,
it's it's because people hold our currency, right? So China is trading with us. They have an interest in producing a lot of things to sell to us and collecting US dollars in return. And so it's not that China is buying our US debt because we need them to buy our bonds to fund ourselves. It's China is trading with the US at a massive rate and is collecting a large amount of US dollars as a result. And so we give them an option to convert those US dollars into an interest earning security. And that's basically all it is. It's a trade result. It's not a financing mechanism in the sense that a business has to go out and raise capital and get someone to kind of buy their debt or, you know, lend them money. So it's a whole different framework to think of it.
So, maybe just one last follow-up and then I'll let Michael jump in. But like under MMT, like this theory, you know, if the debt doesn't matter, right? We still have finite resources, right? So like, you know, if I want to buy, like Eisenhower, this thing, you know, every school we build is like, you know, or every bomb we drop is one less school we have, or, you know, something like that.
Right, exactly.
Right?
There's choices, right?
Yeah, you're right. I can't build, you know, 10 aircraft carriers and, you know, do all this stuff. So inevitably we have to make these choices as a democracy. That's the political process. But I guess, you know, in a way of framing into people's minds, money can just be like the point system that we allocate to these different projects, right? You know, exactly. A school is $1 million. A bomber is this many dollars, right? When Michael shot his missile, you know, that he has shoulder mounted, that was $20,000, right? So, I mean, I don't know. It's just, you know, we could be using dollars, we could be using something else. It's just, we have a certain number of points we have to allocate.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, MMT does use that analogy quite a bit to help people understand the nature of the monetary system, is that it is a lot like kind of points on a scoreboard, right? It's just... we as a country, we have the US dollar in Japan, they got the yen. You know, you create a unit of account, and then you issue some kind of liabilities in that that causes the need for the population to use it. And then, you know, you start creating it and paying for your military or your courts or your education system and whatever, and off you go. And you've got a circulating economic system that functions at the core, at the start, the inception of it is some kind of public institution that is kind of setting that up. And I think that's a big part of the MMT project more broadly, is to reclaim this public space around the currency, around the monetary system, and its importance in serving the public good, and move the debate away from these kind of artificial scarcity discussions that happen that are under a kind of a fictitious financing framework, and move it into a what is in the public interest framework, and what do we have available to us? What can we create? I mean, resources, this question of inflation and resources is not a static one, right? We can create capacity quite quickly in this country. And so we've got to be really careful with these kind of even shifting into well, inflation is the constraint or resources are the constraint. Yes, but let's look at that really carefully. Let's make sure we're not just kind of, you know, shooting ourselves in the foot by saying, oh, we can't do that because we had 2.5% inflation. Wait a minute, give it a little time. Let some entrepreneurship, you know, come in here and innovation, and maybe we'll find a solution to that thing that's creating the issue. And off we go again, and we've got more capacity, right?
So I want to make sure I get this wrapped up and understand kind of the debt issuance. So we issue treasury bonds, but essentially we don't have to. We have this line item as interest on debt of $400 billion. And that's money that's already spent, essentially. We said we're going to pay these people the $400 billion, and we're going to pay them that.
Yeah.
But essentially, you're saying, if, you know, with MMT theory says we don't have to create new bonds for the next round of spending that we have. Am I getting that right?
Yes. So sitting aside whatever laws might be on the books, which can be changed, or what policies are, or, you know, kind of procedures are in place that have kind of become ingrained that could also be changed. So all that stuff's malleable. At kind of a fundamental level, the way that I find most useful to make the comparison to help people in their thinking on this is that when you go to your bank, think of the Fed as the bank. When you go to your bank and you got a checking account, and maybe your bank offers a savings account and maybe a CD, you know, certificate of deposit that you can lock money up for 3 months or 6 months or a year, and they give you an interest rate on that, right? Those are both accounts at the bank. When you put your money out of your checking account into the CD, you've shifted it from one account to another, but you haven't created a debt, right, that is suddenly owed. The bank already owed you the $100 that you shifted. If it was $100 and you put it into a CD, they still owe you the $100, only now they've just said they're going to pay a little interest on it. But there's no new debt relationship there. And I think that's the key thing to understand. Basically, the reserve balances and the security balances, treasuries, you know, treasury bonds, et cetera, or T-bills, versus just settlement funds. They're just two different accounts at the Fed. One earns interest, one doesn't. In fact, actually right now, the Fed's paying interest on reserves. So they're paying interest on their checking account.
But I think it's worth noting that a lot of, you know, we always use the scare tactic of China is buying all of our debt. So we owe all this money to China. But the Federal Reserve buys a large portion of the bonds. Is that correct? And so we actually, essentially, if the Federal Reserve is buying the bonds, we owe them, the Treasury owes the money to the Federal Reserve, we essentially just owe the money to ourselves. Is that what we're saying here?
You know, the Fed is just constantly in and out of the funds market in order to kind of meet its objectives, primarily around interest rate management, but also you know, kind of other factors. It's trying to encourage behavior, et cetera, in the market. So yeah, there's really there's nothing really there to see, you know. I mean, that sort of the key thing here is like we worry about, you know, what happens if the Treasury has to go issue bonds and no one buys them, and suddenly, like, what on earth are we going to do, right? Well, the Fed would step in and make sure a market clears. That's going to be their job. Now, that basically the government's designated certain big banks to play that money market, you know, kind of role where they, it's their job to clear. So the Fed stands behind those banks. And so, you know, the JP Morgans of the world, et cetera, they're all going to make sure every Treasury auction clears and the bonds are sold, because it's basically law that they do that. Today, what's driving all this is basically some rules on the books that says the Treasury has to have a certain amount of money in this account, the general account at the Fed, in order to make payments. And so it has to get that money, I'm putting that in air quotes, into its account. Well, if there aren't tax receipts that are crediting it in the amount at that given time that it needs, because there's a big outflow going to, you know, Social Security or something that month, then they just got to go do some magic behind the scenes with the Fed and the markets, and, you know, buy and sell some bonds one way or the other, right? And so it's just all kind of an operational machination that's very, very well coordinated between the different institutions of government, the Fed and the Treasury, and their kind of extended franchises in the banking system, to just make sure all that runs smoothly and none of us have to worry. Meanwhile, politicians are out there trying to make us all worried. And so, that's the problem. We shouldn't be worried about this stuff. We should be worried about other stuff, but not that.
So, all right, we've touched on the politicians. All right, I think for the most part, I think we've beat that horse to death a little bit about, in, you know, the national debt and, you know, paying our interest and everything. But I think it's worth looking at the practical side of things. Mm-hmm. We have politics. End of the day, the politicians are deciding how we spend this money. And as from what I can tell, I've looked back a little bit here, a few years, from what I can tell is the Republicans and the Democrats are all MMT. They're all on board with MMT, from what I can tell, because you look back at somebody like Ronald Reagan. You know, he had this great economic plan, right? But he actually increased our national debt by 186%. Huge increase, right? We criticized Obama for increasing it by 100% about, right? He doubled the national debt, Barack Obama, the Democrat. It increased substantially under Bush. He did massive tax cuts. And he actually criticized Clinton for running a surplus, because Clinton ran a surplus, didn't have a deficit per se. And he came in and said, well, obviously the federal government has too much, is bringing in too much money. We need to cut taxes. So, and Bush is, I think his tax cuts are almost forgotten because he was such a, you know, his presidency was so dominated by 9/11 and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Right. And then we come into, you know, Trump. After Obama left office, he increased spending, increased the national debt per se. And then Trump comes in and also increase the national debt through tax cuts, but also increase spending, especially on the military front. We had COVID-19 hit and we increased spending again. And I guess the whole time, everyone keeps crying about inflation. No matter whoever's not in charge seems to be crying about inflation, right? When the Republicans are in charge, the Democrats say, oh, what are you going to do? How are you going to pay for that? What about inflation? When the Democrats are in charge, the Republicans come in and say, how are you going to... But we've been running this, it seems like, since Ronald Reagan, 40 years now, and we don't have a massive inflation problem. And I even noted, I was listening to our Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell talk the other day. One of the lawmakers addressed him in one of his many, I don't know, he's given so much testimony on Capitol Hill here recently. But they said, you know, what about inflation? And he said, the money supply, we need to unlearn. Jerome Powell said, we need to unlearn the fact that money supply is tied to inflation. I think 25% of all dollars have been created in the past year or so, and somehow inflation is still holding under 2%.
Right.
All right. So I hit on a lot there. What's your take on this politics-wise? Is there a party better suited to handle MMT? Are they both already doing MMT?
Yeah, so probably the way I'd respond to that is So MMT isn't really something you do. It's knowledge, right? It's a way of understanding our monetary system. And you can act on that knowledge in a whole range of ways. And so I'd say it is somewhat true. I'd say it's definitely true that in the past, our government has had a very robust knowledge at a pretty broad institutional level about how to use the currency well and optimize it. And I'd say the last time it was at its peak was probably World War II. We knew we had a challenge as a country to meet. We knew how to meet it. We knew the resources we needed to deploy, and we knew we had to deploy currency to get those resources deployed. And it was going to create a significant shift in our entire shape of our economy. And we had number one to manage was the risk of inflation because of the sheer capacity of you know, government influence into the economy that was going to go on in the war effort. And so they set up pretty robust mechanisms to do that. One, just trying to defer spending by people by selling bonds. You know, the whole war bond thing was really a marketing effort to get people not to spend, right? So they wouldn't use resources that were needed to go to the war effort. It wasn't a fundraising effort. It was the fact that the government was putting so much money into the economy, they needed people not to spend it, and they didn't want to do it all through taxes. And so they basically said, stick it on the shelf and don't spend that money. Here's a bond.
That's fascinating. I've never heard that before, but that's a great take on that.
Yeah. So there, if you look back at the, you know, the head of the New York Fed at the time, you know, Beardsley Rummel and Eccles and these kind of people, they wrote a lot of stuff at that period, really breaking down a lot of things that MMT has been kind of trying to expound on. There's a great Beardsley Rummel piece called Taxes for Our for Revenues. Taxes for Revenues is obsolete. And it basically just says, listen, we don't use taxes to get money, but we use it for other reasons. Here's what they are. And it's a great article written in the 40s, I think. So anyway, kind of fast forward, we've had this institutional capacity. Question is, how many in Congress today understand this? I'm kind of skeptical. People say, you know, everyone gets MMT. It's like, yes and no. I mean, they know that the government issues a currency, but they're also just horribly confused and they're all playing politics. And so you'll hear conflicting things come out of politicians all the time on this because it's politically expedient for them to make a case one way or the other. You know, it might be expedient for them to be, you know, saying we're, you know, racking up the credit card. This is all just it's language, right? It's emotive language trying to get a response. It's political. How many really get the inner workings and the full implications of an MMT framework? I still think it's probably a minority, but it's a growing number. We've actually got a number of folks in Congress now that are fairly actively engaged with MMT scholars, you know, trying to just really get into the weeds of, you know, how can we use the currency better, the monetary system better in public policy, and how do we use better language to make the case for public policy that gets away from this kind of false scarcity mentality.
So can I interrupt maybe just so quick question. So the MMT theory, you know, I get how maybe applies to America, but maybe I'll just give you a hypothetical. Say I am a different country, right? Say I'm like, you know, Germany or Venezuela, right? You know, and I have these, you know, I guess I have these demands and I want to, you know, I want to use my currency to buy resources from other countries, right? So mm-hmm. I guess, you know, I know that I guess America, we're this kind of dominant world power. We can kind of sway, you know, we have, you know, military power, we have, you know, this enormous economic power. But if you're a small country trying to apply, does this MMT theory work if you're a smaller country, if you're not the dominant global player? Can you treat your debt like this as well? Assuming it's not pegged to another currency.
Yeah, so there's actually some really good work that's gone on. Fadel Kaboub is a scholar that has done quite a lot of work in on looking at some of the emerging economies and challenged economies from an MMT perspective. He has a family background in the Middle East and Tunisia. And so he's kind of looked at some of their economies and others. And others have too, in terms of consulting with foreign governments on some of this stuff. So to answer the question somewhat directly, so as I said earlier, some countries are in a tangle because they've gotten themselves deep into debt in something other than their own currency. So this is part of the problem. I think the US and the IMF and the World Bank have created globally is a dependence on US dollars for financing of sovereign currencies. And it creates a something akin to a gold debt where you don't create the US dollar, but you owe it. And so it forces these countries into a kind of dependence in exports to earn US dollars to then pay their debt. I think my own personal view on that is it's an unhealthy way to run a global economy. And I think the US needs to kind of own up to that and work toward a better solution. But setting aside some of those types of situations or those that have pegged their currency to another currency or you know, things like that, or even all of Europe, they all gave up their monetary systems and decided to use the euro, but without any kind of central fiscal government to like the US dollars to kind of push those euros out into all of the needy parts of the union. They kind of created a bit of a problem for themselves, right? But I'm from New Zealand. New Zealand is a pretty small economy. It has its own currency. It functions just fine as a country with its own currency, just like many, many others. It is not in debt in US dollars in any significant way. And so it can keep issuing New Zealand dollars for public needs in New Zealand as long as it can manage its kind of resource balance and inflation, et cetera. So that's just one example. You can go around the world and look at many where I don't think any country is optimizing their currency to the level that I think all of us would like to see. In kind of the MMT world, we're all looking at, listen, we've got significant global and national challenges to tackle. We have the ability to do this. We've got the people, we've got resources, we've got a willingness among so many to tackle this stuff. We can do it in a way that's going to end up in a, with a good outcome.
So maybe just hounding that in. So maybe I make you president for a day and you can make as many changes that you could practically do it. So like, what would be your big changes? Like, how would we make this run smoother? Or how do we remove this inefficiency? Like, how would you use MMT to make a practical difference in the world if you had that power to change laws and do this?
Right. I mean, it's probably many, many facets to that. And I'm probably not even the best person to even tackle most of them, but think of like developing countries or smaller or resource constrained countries, right? A country that doesn't have its own good local food and energy sources has real challenges, right? And so one, we should all try to help each other as a world to be able to survive and prosper in this planet that we share. So I think more can be done in a non-debt-based capacity of helping places that are trying to do the right thing and get on their feet. Establish rather than establish dependence, which is basically what the imperial and colonial history of the world has been, was create kind of vassal states, right? And we do it now through U.S. debt in an effective way, U.S. dollar debt. Only slightly it's better than, but probably has similar effects of colonial era, where there's just low wage, impoverished countries giving up their natural resources to feed our hungry economy and others in the West. Those are the kinds of things I think we should shift and work toward more of a win-win, kind of help everyone maximize their local resources as well as, share what can or should be shared for kind of a do no harm and ultimately do good, kind of better everybody result. At a kind of stepping away from the global picture, if you're looking at nationally, and particularly in a place like the US, so a fundamental component of the MMT framework is this idea of a job guarantee. And so if you think about the concept of unemployment as a result of someone wanting to earn the US currency and not able to, it's a shortage, it's a creation of or a vestige of the way that we run our economy. That is something very easily solved by having a standing offer by the government to employ anyone who is willing, ready, and able to work at a certain wage. And that basically rises and falls with how the economy is doing. So when the private sector has no need for a lot of people and they start letting them go, they can fall into this kind of social sector, if you will, that are people working in local community projects and whatever we come up with that is interesting and valuable and keeps people skilled and connected and earning income. And then as the private sector needs more people, they've got an employed resource to pull from of people that are active and still, you know, learning skills to do that. And that's an anti-inflationary, it's kind of buffer stock way of thinking about the economy, right? So it helps manage this kind of ups and downs and the inflation risk. So that would be a really important policy to throw in place. I think there's a lot of stuff that MMTers have written about in terms of financial regulation and kind of reining in the excesses of the finance sector. I think a lot of that is because a lot of what they do is not as necessary as they'd like us to think it is. And there are alternatives to the way it's done today. You know, we can get into obviously a lot of political questions here too. You know, there's no reason we can't fund elections without creating all this money flooding in from billionaires to kind of sway what the public thinks. We've got a public purse to pay for things like that, and other countries do it quite well. So there's all kinds of things you can start tackling when you start thinking of money as an infinite resource, and that infinite resource comes into the spectrum of you know, real resources and real communities and real people. How do you bring that infinite thing into this more, you know, concrete existent thing and cause that to result in a positive result? And it's, you can tackle a myriad of political and social and, you know, ecological issues with that.
So I want to touch on something, because you mentioned earlier about, you know, shifting construction for condos from condos to, you know, rail construction in the Midwest. You mentioned the job guarantee. Is MMT a step towards socialism, or are we still maintaining the private sector as it is?
I mean, it's really unrelated. I generally don't like isms, because a lot of people have meaning behind those words that may not be shared with you know, all sides of the conversation and listeners. So I don't even know what most people think when they say socialism, because it's,
I think people, you know, people view, for the most part, socialism, at least I think in the general terms of it, you say socialism, that means the government dictates everything. The government says, we're going to build a road here, we're going to build a house here, and you're going to go build this house, and you're going to go build this road, and you're going to be a doctor. Is there, mm-hmm. And you know, the private sector says, well, you can go do what you want, and there's going to be, you know, the construction worker might make $50,000 and the doctor might make $150,000. So there's incentives, mm-hmm. but the construction worker might have a you know, a few months of a program or a trade school to go to, where the doctor has to go to 10 years of school. And right. So there's all these trade-offs that you have to balance with, you know, free market versus socialism. You're assigned to a certain thing. I mean, yeah. I guess my big question there is, if MMT is, you know, the dominant theory and everyone's thinking like that, okay, we need to build these rails, or all of a sudden we're not going to build houses that we might need because the politics don't quite align with it. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, is this job guarantee, yeah. is that going to create this, I guess a universal income more or less, or are people actually going to still be expected to work? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to play devil's advocate here a little bit, but I'm curious. Yeah, sure. I just hear the arguments coming from the other side.
Right. Yeah, no, and I know them well. I used to have them myself. So, so, you know, take the job guarantee as an example. It is fundamentally designed as a buffer of human labor capacity that sits between the public sector and the private sector. And it fluctuates based on the needs of each. And so it's not, there's nothing inherent in MMT that says, the answer to the world's problems is socialism. I'll just give my own view on this. I don't know what every person working in this field thinks and kind of their political views. I do think there's some common interests, but at a kind of fundamental level, this whole, to use isms, capitalism versus socialism, let me say it differently. This idea of a pure free market is a fiction, and this idea of an entirely government run world is a fiction. Those things don't exist, right? What we have is something in between, that we have economies where there is a government there. We constitute our country. We have laws. Those are government functioning, administrative and legal systems that create, a corporation is a legal entity because we have a government granting it certain powers and enforcing those powers. And so this whole idea of like this adverse relationship between public and private, I think we're like way too tied up in knots over this. And what we should be thinking about is how are we looking at the things that we want to achieve as a people and working through the process, the political process and economic process we have to achieve them, and debating what's the right way to do it. Just because the government pays for something doesn't mean the government is doing that thing, right? Healthcare is a great example. There are multiple different government-paid healthcare systems around the world that have varying degrees of private sector involvement. We can keep our current system, have the government pay insurance companies a profit just to be there if we want. It's a waste of money, but we could do that. The government could wipe out the insurance industry, but still would have all the same private providers on the other side, all the doctors and the the hospitals and et cetera, et cetera. They could all be private businesses. Or you can go the UK route and just have the government, everyone's a government employee and government run hospitals, et cetera. I'd say in the US, you're probably not going to have that. At any point, I think we'll always have a robust private sector and the government paying quite a decent chunk of things that we think is in the interests of the public for the government to pay. That's where those lines get drawn will vary, every election cycle probably. But that's where I think we are. We've got a lot of problems. This pandemic has shown up that we all realize, I'm sorry to kind of pick on this, but I'm picking on myself here from my own former views, but kind of the libertarian ideal of, all these free individuals running around doing what they want. It doesn't solve pandemic response very well, right? I mean, we've seen you need that agent to step in and say, and they didn't do it very well this time around, but here's a check to stay afloat, small business. Here's some money to keep paying your rent and keep your staff around until we can reopen your restaurant. I mean, those are the kinds of things we can do if we put our mind and our financial capacity as a country behind it, and we could ride through these crises far, far better for both the local communities and the economy as a whole without disrupting, private enterprise.
Fair enough. I think that was a great response. I think that is a lot of how it is done. We draw these lines and we say, this person's for capitalism, this person's for socialism. But at the same time, I don't see anybody saying, let's get rid of fire departments. That's a social project. Let's get rid of the interstate highway. That's a social project. But I think, most capitalists could get on board with that and say, I like having my highways and my fire department. I don't want the fire truck to pull up to my house and ask me to swipe a credit card before they go in to rescue people or put out the fire.
Right. I mean, I've been in business, a long time, and I'm all I'll just tell you, it's just affection that people don't want the government. I mean, everyone loves to hate them for what they don't like about them, but they all want them around for what they're lobbying for, right? And what they're trying to, you know, achieve, and, you know, the infrastructure that we rely on, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's a combined, our economy is a combined public private system, and it's always going to be that way. And we've just got to figure out how to do it better. And that's going to be a constant debate.
So I do want to start to wrap things up here. I know we've been going for just a little over an hour now, and I know this is a lot to digest, but I think, Brian, did you have something?
Oh, no, I think that was, yeah, all very interesting discussion. And I think about your isms. I just, when you're talking about, you know, roads and highways, I was just, you ever watched the show Parks and Recreation? There's a guy named Ron Swanson on the show. He's this libertarian who works in government at a public park. And I just, like, one of his big jokes was like, you know, all right, guys, like, let's all take out the stop signs, man. I can't wait to get out there, you know, be a libertarian. And of course, you know, all the libertarians, you know, this is their mentality. So he's a hardcore one. But like, to your point, I think people appreciate stop signs. I think people appreciate, you know, public goods. And I think to your point about, you know, the pandemic response, you know, I think you're right. You know, for like building a nuclear bomb and, you know, fighting a war and, you know, doing certain things, I think government maybe does a better job than, you know, maybe a pure libertarian system.
Right. Yeah.
The accent once or twice. I'm glad you mentioned that you're from New Zealand originally. I've never been. If I'm going to New Zealand, where should I visit? Where's my one spot that I should visit on my first trip to New Zealand?
Oh man, well, I'm a big fan of the South Island. That's always weird. Head to the mountains when I was a kid and go hiking down there, tramping as we call it, sometimes for a couple of weeks at a time. And so the scenery is stunning, but it kind of depends if are you a beach guy or a mountain guy.
I love hiking, I'm right there with you.
So I'm a big fan of the South Island.
All right, great. Well, I really appreciate that. Well, we do have one last section. We'd like to have a little bit of fun here. Brian brings us the question of the day. I haven't heard it. Our guest has never heard it. So, Brian, if you could take it away. This is off topic.
This is just, yeah, totally off topic today. This is an interesting statistic I came across. So, well, there's two data points in time. So I'm going to have you guess a percentage, okay? So one's going to be from 1970 and one is 2018. And the question is, what percentage of American adults aged 25 to 50 have never been married? So basically, what percentage of American adults 25 to 50 have never been married now, so in 2018,
yeah,
versus 1970? So what do you think? Americans 25 to 50, never been married. What's the number? Never. Michael, you can go first if you want. You can go first. I'm up to you.
So now versus then, I'm guessing it's lower now than then. And never been married, I'll say 15% in the earlier year, and 30% now.
I see. You think it's gone up. So 30% of people now are currently between 25 to 50 are not married.
Right.
Okay. So 15 and 30 are your two numbers. Okay. What do you think, Michael?
I wrote them down, and I wrote down 15 and 25. So I'm pretty much in line with him.
All right. So, okay, drum roll. The answer is 1970, it was only 9% of Americans between 25 to 50 had never been married. And then moving up to 2018, the number increased to 35% of Americans ages 25 to 50, or 39 million, had never been married. So a dramatic increase. And I don't know if that's because people aren't getting married, or they're just, you know, cohabitating, or, you know, what's happening. But that's just kind of a societal shift that's happened.
Fascinating, yeah.
That is really interesting. I think we got it that 1970 was definitely a lower number, but we missed it, you know.
We were pretty close, within 5%.
We didn't go low enough.
Yeah.
Didn't get low enough, yeah.
We didn't go high enough on the other side. You got closer on the current. So that's a really interesting one.
It reminds me of those questions where they ask people about how unequal the U.S. economy is, and most people make it far less unequal than it really is in their perception. So
that's right. Yeah.
Well, Jeff, you mentioned the deficit myth as a book. We're going to link to that. Is there, if somebody wanted to find you, where's the best place for them to find you or to find out more about MMT?
Sure. So I am at Glad Kiwi on Twitter. And I wrote the kind of beginner's website, modernmoneybasics.com. There's a little YouTube video and a website that was really just designed, much like your podcast, to introduce these ideas in a very, very simple way to, you know, someone you'd share with your friend that doesn't know economics at all. I don't know if I achieved that goal, but that was the goal. There are a lot of folks I'd highly recommend anyone interested in. They're far smarter than me and much more learned on the topic to follow on Twitter. But Stephanie Kelton is obviously a good place to start, who wrote that book. And then the Modern Money Network, Rowan Gray is the head of that, who's also on Twitter. He's very active along with his colleagues in some of the discussion around kind of cryptocurrencies and kind of the broader kind of future of digital currency as it intersects with MMT and these ideas of the public, you know, the commons around, you know, the public domain of money and institutional, constitutional origins of money.
Well, perfect. We really appreciate that. We'll link to all those people in the show notes. We'll definitely link to the website, Modern Money Basics. That YouTube video helped get my mind around it when I first, I first just came across a random tweet from you replying to somebody else I was following on Twitter. And that's what brought it. So I think that's a great resource. And then definitely, if you want to dive into it deeper, The Deficit Myth, that is on my reading list. I haven't read it yet, but I will definitely be, hopefully by the end of 2021 here, if the family allows it, I will get that read.
Fantastic.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for coming on today. We really do appreciate it. It's been a fantastic conversation. We didn't even touch on the cryptocurrency aspect of this. So maybe we put a feather in that and come back another time.
Yeah. And I'd actually recommend folks like Rowan or some of his colleagues would be exceptional on that. They're far more up on some of that stuff. They're writing some of the white papers around the stuff and responding to things like Facebook's Libra currency and stuff like that. So they're way more in the weeds. I'd be probably not the ideal person to dig into some of that.
All right. Well, that sounds... we'll touch base.
Yeah. Well, that sounds great. Thanks, Jeff. Yeah. Great. It's been a pleasure having you here.
Likewise. Good to meet you guys and all the best.
All right. Well, this has been Trading for Keeps. I'm Brian.
And this is Michael. Thanks for tuning in.
Trading for Keeps is not intended as investment advice. It is only intended for entertainment purposes. We do receive some affiliate commissions from links in our show notes.